Have you ever wondered how a single moment can alter the trajectory of multiple lives forever? Mary Beth Keane's Ask Again Yes explores this question with devastating precision. This New York Times bestseller captivated readers worldwide upon its 2019 release, earning a spot on Jimmy Fallon's Summer Reads list and becoming a Book of the Month Club selection. The novel resonated deeply with readers for its unflinching examination of family bonds, mental illness, and the possibility of redemption. In an era where conversations about mental health are increasingly important, Keane's nuanced portrayal of how psychological struggles affect entire families feels both timely and timeless. The story of two neighboring families connected and divided by tragedy speaks to anyone who has ever wondered if love can truly overcome the past. Francis Gleason and Brian Stanhope first crossed paths as rookie cops at New York's 41st Precinct in the early 1970s, during the city's notoriously challenging decade. Their initial partnership on the force becomes defining when they discover the body of a local grocer, shot point blank during what appears to be a routine robbery. The case culminates in a tense foot chase through the South Bronx, ending with them apprehending a teenage suspect who shows no remorse. That evening, while Stanhope regales their fellow officers with an embellished version of events at Flanagan's Bar, Francis quietly slips away, haunted by the dead man's open eyes. He finds solace with his fiancée, Lena, who intuitively understands his need for silence and reminds him of their plans to move to the suburbs, away from the city's escalating violence. Several years later, the Gleasons have established themselves in Gillam, a peaceful suburb north of the city. Their colonial house on Oak Street becomes home to their growing family, including their spirited daughter, Natalie. When the Stanhopes purchase the house next door, it seems like fate has reunited the former partners. Lena, 8 months pregnant with her second child and yearning for companionship in their quiet neighborhood, reaches out to Anne Stanhope with characteristic warmth. During their first interaction, Anne mentions her own pregnancy in such a subdued manner that Lena almost misses it. Despite Lena's persistent attempts at friendship, bringing over homemade lasagna, offering gently used baby clothes, suggesting coffee dates, Anne maintains an impenetrable wall of politeness that borders on hostility. After Peter's birth, Anne returns Lena's carefully selected baby items in a brown paper bag left on the porch without a note. The dynamic between the two households develops into a strange choreography. Francis and Brian maintain their professional camaraderie, sharing occasional beers in the driveway and discussing precinct politics, while their wives operate in parallel universes despite living just feet apart. The children, Kate Gleason and Peter Stanhope, grow up sharing a property line but inhabiting separate worlds. Yet there's an inexplicable connection from the start. Kate's first concrete memory is of 3-year-old Peter in his backyard, his red ball bouncing against the fence. She recalls knowing his name without anyone telling her, as if it were knowledge she was born with, a prescient detail that foreshadows their future entanglement. The contrast between the two households becomes increasingly stark. The Gleason's home radiates warmth and stability, filled with the chaos of family dinners, homework sessions, and weekend gatherings. Meanwhile, the Stanhope's house develops an aura of careful silence. Anne's behavior becomes increasingly concerning, marked by extended periods where she disappears into her bedroom, emerging days later as if nothing happened. During these episodes, Brian works longer shifts, finding refuge in overtime hours, while young Peter assumes responsibilities far beyond his years. Neighbors observe the elementary school-aged boy carrying grocery bags home, preparing his own meals, and watching worriedly through windows while other children play street hockey outside. The seeds of dysfunction take root, setting the stage for future complications that will affect both families in ways they cannot yet imagine.
Anne Stanhope's mental illness manifests in increasingly concerning ways as Peter grows up. When Peter is in sixth grade, he discovers his mother has deliberately destroyed an expensive model ship she had given him. When confronted, she slaps him twice, triggering a destructive outburst from Peter until his father intervenes. Rather than removing Peter from the volatile situation, Brian returns home with his son after a brief attempt to leave, sharing stories of his own difficult childhood with an alcoholic mother and suggesting Peter should be grateful for what he has. The situation deteriorates further when Anne has a public breakdown at a grocery store. She becomes convinced everyone has conspired against her, removing her shoes and scarf before confronting the crowd, shouting, "Stop looking at me," repeatedly. An ambulance is called while Peter waits in the car. When emergency responders discover Brian's service weapon in Anne's handbag, it creates professional complications for Brian. In the aftermath, Anne begins taking medication, creating an atmosphere where what family members say isn't what they mean. Though Anne seems better, Brian grows distant, and Peter discovers a pamphlet about South Carolina, realizing his father wants to leave their troubled home. The portrayal of mental illness here is heartbreaking in its realism. Anne isn't simply a villain. She's a woman struggling with serious psychological issues that affect everyone around her. The narrative explores how mental illness was poorly understood and inadequately treated in the 1980s, with families often left to manage crises on their own. Brian's ineffectual responses, placating Anne during outbursts before escaping to television, the garage, or local pub, highlight how unprepared many families were to handle mental health challenges. Peter's experience shows how children of mentally ill parents often develop hypervigilance and premature responsibility. He learns to anticipate his mother's moods, prepare meals when she cannot, and navigate her unpredictable behavior. These coping mechanisms shape his personality and relationships in ways that will follow him into adulthood. As teenagers, Peter and Kate develop a friendship that begins to evolve into something more romantic. Their connection forms despite, or perhaps because of, their complicated family dynamics. When Anne witnesses an intimate moment between them after Kate injures herself, she reacts with unmistakable anger, ordering Peter inside and showing no concern for Kate's injury. The next day, Anne forbids Peter from returning to school, not just that day, but ever, including his upcoming graduation. When Peter defies her, Anne grabs a meat mallet and rushes at him. Though Peter manages to disarm her, the incident marks a dangerous escalation in her behavior. That night, Kate and Peter arrange to meet secretly. Peter reveals his father is leaving to live with his uncle in Queens, explaining that he feels he should stay with his mother despite her behavior. He tells Kate about his mother's public breakdown at Food King, then kisses her and confesses he's thought about marrying her someday. Their rendezvous is discovered when Lena realizes Kate is missing. The families erupt into argument, with Francis furiously telling Kate to make a new friend and stay away from those people. The situation reaches its catastrophic climax when Peter appears at the Gleason's door asking to use their phone to call the police, calmly reporting that his mother has his father's gun. Francis rushes to the Stanhopes' house, certain this must be a misunderstanding. When Anne opens the door, looking pained but empty-handed, Francis steps inside, asking about Brian. In that moment, Anne reaches under a couch cushion, pulls out a gun, and fires, forever altering the trajectory of both families. The shooting scene is masterfully rendered, not as a melodramatic climax, but as the tragic culmination of untreated mental illness, familial dysfunction, and societal failure. The moment is both shocking and somehow inevitable, the logical conclusion to the tension that has been building throughout the narrative. After the shooting, the families are torn apart. Peter moves to Queens with his father Brian and Uncle George, eating off paper plates in front of the TV and adjusting to urban life after suburban Gillam. Brian's mental state deteriorates as he skips work to ride the bus aimlessly, then suddenly announces he's moving to South Carolina for a security guard position. His invitation for Peter to join him feels perfunctory, and Peter chooses to stay with George, who offers stability and genuine care. Meanwhile, Francis endures a grueling recovery from his injuries, with Lena helping him with everything from showering to basic mobility. The Gleason girls react differently to their father's condition.
Natalie and Sarah avoid looking directly at him while maintaining forced cheerfulness, while Pate studies his injuries intently, even analyzing the bullet's trajectory to understand what happened. Peter visits his mother on Sundays at the State Psychiatric Hospital in Westchester, taking the train and walking nearly 2 miles to reach her. Initially, after her commitment, doctors and lawyers prevented him from seeing her, suggesting it might upset her fragile mental state. During his first visit, Anne appears heavily medicated, overweight, and distant. She tells Brian she regrets meeting him, but becomes emotional seeing Peter, telling him not to return. As time passes, Brian visits Anne less frequently, making excuses about work while spending Sundays at the local bar instead. Peter continues his visits despite the challenges, sometimes only able to see his mother through a glass panel in a padded room. The hospital staff reluctantly allows Peter, a minor, to visit his mother alone, though her condition varies dramatically from visit to visit. This period reveals the lasting impact of trauma on both families. For the Gleasons, life revolves around Francis's recovery and adapting to his new limitations. For Peter, the aftermath means separation from everything familiar, his home, his school where he would have been valedictorian, and especially Kate, whom he thinks about less frequently but still wonders about. The narrative poignantly captures how systems fail families in crisis. The psychiatric hospital where Anne is committed offers little therapeutic benefit, focusing more on containment than healing. Peter, a teenager dealing with extraordinary circumstances, receives minimal support. Brian essentially abandons his responsibilities, leaving his brother George to step in as Peter's surrogate parent. Years pass with Peter and Kate living separate lives. Peter excels academically at his new school, Dutch Kills Preparatory, and becomes the second best runner on the cross-country team. However, he maintains emotional distance from his peers, once inventing a girlfriend back home to deflect questions. His uncle George becomes his true parent figure, even purchasing real porcelain plates to replace their paper ones in a touching gesture of permanence and care. Kate returns to school but barely remembers her final month. At graduation, Peter's absence is notable. He would have been valedictorian. Throughout the summer and beyond, Kate constantly hopes Peter will call or write, checking the mail daily and answering the phone whenever possible. When Lena finds Kate on the couch one evening, she acknowledges that Kate misses Peter and reveals that at Anne's hearing, she had threatened to kill Kate if she went near Peter again. Lena explains to Kate that Anne is mentally ill, which is why she did what she did. Kate transitions into high school with surprising ease, making friends quickly and joining the soccer team. Her parents are delighted by her apparent social success, unaware that Kate fabricates details about her friendships to please them. Despite her outward adjustment, Kate feels an emptiness without Peter. In her sophomore year, she begins dating Eddie Merrick, a handsome senior, though their relationship lacks the depth of her connection with Peter. Meanwhile, Peter continues visiting his mother, whose condition fluctuates with medication changes. After Brian moves to Georgia, Anne is transferred to Albany, 2 hours away, a move that happens without Peter's knowledge. When Peter tells George he's considering taking a year off before college to work with ironworkers, George encourages him to accept a full scholarship to Elliott College instead, telling him to use the brain God gave you. This period demonstrates how trauma shapes but doesn't define these characters. Both Peter and Kate find ways to move forward, Peter through academic achievement and running, Kate through soccer and social connections. Yet beneath their functional exteriors, both carry unresolved feelings about their shared past and separation. Years later, while attending Elliott College on scholarship, Peter writes Kate an impulsive letter after visiting his mother at the psychiatric hospital. Though he immediately regrets sending it, this letter initiates their reconnection. When they finally meet at a bar in New York City, Peter arrives early and downs shots of Jameson to calm his nerves. Though Kate looks different with purple-dyed hair and Doc Martens, their connection remains intact.
they quickly fall into a comfortable relationship, visiting each other often and speaking daily, carefully avoiding discussions of Gillum or the incident between their families. Their relationship feels both familiar and new, with small domestic moments bringing Kate profound happiness. Though they don't feel like normal college students, they try to act the part, embracing college life and drinking heavily, like they were getting paid, as Kate puts it. After graduation, Peter moves in with his uncle George and works construction, while Kate accepts a criminalist position with the NYPD. When George meets Kate as Peter helps her move apartments, he expresses concern about their relationship. Of all the fish in the sea, Peter, George worries their relationship means all that stuff from years ago didn't end back then. Inspired by a conversation with George about how policing had changed, Peter secretly begins the police application process. During his formal interview, the investigator questions Peter about his family history and reveals knowledge of Anne shooting Francis Gleason. Despite concerns about Peter's psychological evaluation and family background, Francis Gleason surprisingly recommends Peter for the academy, telling them he was a good boy and that what happened wasn't his fault. This section beautifully illustrates how love can transcend trauma. Peter and Kate's reconnection isn't portrayed as a magical cure for their past wounds, but as a conscious choice to build something new together despite their complicated history. Their relationship requires courage from both, courage to trust again, to face potential disapproval from family, and to believe that their shared past doesn't have to determine their future. As Peter and Kate build their life together, troubling patterns emerge. Peter's drinking gradually increases until Kate realizes it has become problematic. Like a scientist accustomed to solving complex problems, Kate struggles to pinpoint when Peter's drinking crossed the line from social enjoyment to dependence. The revelation comes when Kate connects Peter's drinking with an autopsy she worked on, a man with liver damage whose friends reported he only drank beer, not alcohol. The pathologist's correction that beer is alcohol makes Kate realize she's been minimizing Peter's consumption. The crisis point arrives when Peter discharges his weapon during duty and comes home 10 hours later, disheveled and distraught. Francis Gleason arrives unexpectedly that night, having heard through old police connections about the incident. Finding Peter passed out drunk in the basement, Francis confronts Kate about how long this has been happening, revealing that other officers had been covering for Peter. In a moment of desperation, Kate approaches Anne Stanhope, who has been secretly watching their family from a distance for years. Kate asks for information about Peter, his father, and his Irish heritage to better understand what she's dealing with. Anne insists Peter doesn't drink, taking after her rather than his father Brian. This conversation leads to Anne being invited to their home, creating an awkward reunion between Peter and his mother. At Peter's disciplinary hearing, the panel forces him to retire immediately after learning about his family history, particularly that his mother shot his father-in-law years earlier. Francis offers to help pay for rehab, saying, "You're a young man. This seems like the end of everything, but it's not." Kate immediately arranges for Peter to enter treatment, and in a surprising turn, Anne Stanhope helps watch the children while Kate drives Peter to the facility. This section powerfully explores how patterns of addiction, mental illness, and trauma can echo through generations. Peter's alcoholism mirrors his father's drinking problems, though Peter had never recognized the connection. The narrative suggests that unaddressed trauma, like Peter's childhood experiences with his mother's mental illness and the shooting, can manifest in destructive behaviors years later. Yet it also offers hope that with awareness and support, these cycles can be broken. After 33 days in rehab, the longest Peter and Kate have been apart since their years of separation, Peter returns home. Though the children rush to embrace him, their squeals of delight echoing through the house, Kate finds herself paralyzed, rooted to the kitchen floor. Despite knowing she should move forward, should embrace this moment of reunion she'd rehearsed countless times in her mind, she feels something withdraw inside her, like a tide pulling away from shore. The disconnect between her anticipated emotional response and the reality of the moment leaves her questioning everything she thought she knew about forgiveness. The road to recovery proves more treacherous than anyone anticipated. Peter relapses multiple times, the most devastating being when he visits bars while claiming to attend AA meetings. His breath carries the familiar scent of bourbon that Kate had hoped never to smell again. When she discovers his deception one Tuesday evening, she confronts him in their bedroom, asking the question that haunts their marriage: "How can I trust you?" Met with his silence, she drives aimlessly through darkened streets, her knuckles white on the steering wheel. For months afterward, Peter tries desperately to prove himself, attending every meeting, calling his sponsor daily, leaving his phone's location tracking enabled, while Kate maintains emotional distance, going through the motions of their life together, but from behind invisible glass walls that seem to grow thicker with each passing day. Meanwhile, Anne and Francis experience their own unexpected path to reconciliation when both end up watching Peter and Kate's children during a family emergency. In the quiet moments between managing homework and preparing snacks, Francis realizes the years when hating Anne felt important have simply slipped away. He mostly feels sorry for her loneliness now, seeing how she sits slightly apart, even when surrounded by family. He recognizes how much he has by comparison: 3 daughters who call regularly, 7 grandchildren who fill his holidays with chaos and joy, and Lena, whose steady presence anchors his life. By offering Anne a kind of forgiveness he never thought possible, Francis discovers he's lightening his own burden, releasing years of accumulated bitterness. When Brian Stanhope dies years later from a sudden heart attack, leaving his assets to Anne and Peter, despite having lived with another woman, Sarah, for nearly 10 years, it creates another opportunity for healing. The inheritance, substantial from Brian's successful law practice, could have become another source of division. Instead, Anne and Peter make the surprising decision to give Sarah a third of the inheritance, showing a compassion that might have seemed impossible in earlier years. This gesture represents more than money. It acknowledges the complexity of human relationships and the possibility of grace even in difficult circumstances. The novel doesn't offer neat resolution or perfect healing. Instead, it presents forgiveness as an ongoing process, something that must be chosen again and again. Characters must repeatedly choose forgiveness, of others and themselves, as they navigate the aftermath of trauma and betrayal. This nuanced portrayal of healing acknowledges that some wounds never fully close, leaving scars that remain tender to the touch. Yet people can still build meaningful lives around them, creating new patterns of trust and understanding in the spaces where pain once lived. Throughout the novel, characters face moments where they must decide whether to continue investing in difficult relationships or walk away. The title, Ask Again, Wes, refers to this recurring choice. Will they say yes to love, to family, to forgiveness, even when doing so requires tremendous courage and faith? When Peter returns from rehab and Kate feels something withdraw inside her instead of experiencing the joyful reunion she expected, she's confronted with this question. When Peter relapses and Kate asks how she can trust him, they both face it again. Each time, they choose to continue, not because it's easy, but because their connection remains worth fighting for. The novel suggests that what makes relationships endure isn't the absence of problems, but the willingness to face them together. As Kate tells Peter during their drive to rehab, they're facing their problems together, battling side by side through bad times just as they'd vowed. Though Peter worries about their financial future after losing his career, Kate insists none of it matters if he doesn't get his act together. Not for her or the children, but for himself. Even Francis and Anne, divided by violence and decades of bitterness, find a measure of peace when circumstances bring them together again. Francis's realization that the years when hating her felt important had passed speaks to how time can transform even the most justified anger into something more complex and potentially healing. The story ultimately affirms that while we cannot change the past, we can choose how we respond to it. Each character must decide whether to remain defined by trauma or to move beyond it. Not by forgetting what happened, but by refusing to let it determine their future. The novel's power lies in showing how ordinary people navigate extraordinary challenges, finding grace in unexpected places, and building meaningful lives despite profound loss and disappointment. In asking, again, yes to love and connection despite everything, these characters demonstrate remarkable courage. Their journey reminds us that healing is rarely linear, forgiveness is often complicated, and love, in all its messy, imperfect forms, remains our best hope for transcending the wounds of the past.